Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show!
Andrew Talks to Chefs is brought to you in part by Mies, the revolutionary new interactive recipe tool for professional chefs and cooks. Designers use Figma, photographers use Photoshop. Now, finally, chefs have the right tool for recipe development, management, training, and evolution with Mies. Like mise en place, the term that inspired its name, Mies helps chefs and cooks be organized, ready, and efficient, save time and money, eliminate mistakes and redundancies, and guarantee consistency, whether in one restaurant or across a multi-unit company. Visit GetMeez, that's GetMeez.com/Andrew to learn more and sign up for a free trial membership. Andrew Talks to Chefs is brought to you in part by San Pellegrino Sparkling Natural Mineral Water. For more than 120 years, San Pellegrino has been inspiring people to savor life and tasteful moments around the table. As chefs and restaurants have evolved worldwide, San Pellegrino has always been there to complement the food they serve, the moments they create, and to support them in both good and challenging times. Learn more at sanpellegrino.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
The love and admiration and respect shown to him in this book do outweigh the sort of negative parts. But I think overall, he would want, and I know I wanted, and I think that most readers want, a more honest and nuanced look at who this guy was. He was unflinching in his assessment of other people and things, and the way that he could sort of get away with that and balance that out is he was equally honest and unflinching about himself.
That is the voice of Lori Wooliver, author of the new book, Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. Lori is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged derangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. Thank you for joining us. I hope all of you are doing okay during what continues to be a somewhat challenging and at times depressing time. I'm trying to soldier through. I'm trying to keep my chin up. I hope that is true for all of you out there. I know it gets tough sometimes to do that right now. It feels like we're in not just a marathon, but a double marathon with this ongoing pandemic. But I hope all of you are doing as well as possible. My guest today, and I'm thrilled to have her on the show, is someone I've known just a little bit over the years, but for quite a number of years, Lori Wooliver. Lori is, of course, a terrific writer and author. She also, I should mention, co-hosts a podcast called Carb Face, which you may want to check out. It's very amusing and fun and intelligent, as is Lori. Lori, of course, is probably known to most of you listeners out there for her relationship that lasted about a decade. Started off as a kind of a cookbook helper for Anthony Bourdain on his Layal cookbook, became his assistant for about a decade, and in time, of course, became his friend and also his book collaborator. And she has now, along with other things she is working on, become a bit of his, I don't know if you say official or unofficial, but kind of his biographer and historian. And the main product of that role right now is her new book, Bourdain, the Definitive Oral Biography. The book comes out on Tuesday, September 28, 2021. That's just a few days after this interview drops. It is, of course, as things are today, available already for pre-order. I was lucky to have a look at it, and I don't want to get too much into it in the intro because Lori and I talk about most of the things I would say in the intro, but suffice it to say, as all listeners here know, and as is true for many of you out there, Anthony was a very important person to me. Obviously, I'm someone who writes about the chef profession. He was a bit of a North Star for me and kind of figuring out what my own career was about. and someone who was also very kind to me. I saw a lot of his television product. I read probably all of his books, maybe not all of his novels, but all of his nonfiction. I still came away from this book knowing more about him than I ever had, having a much greater sense of him as a three-dimensional, complicated person than I ever knew him to be personally. I didn't really know him all that well, although I got to meet him several times. And the book to me, I think this is a crucial part of any biography. Laura uses this word herself in the conversation. It's not just a hagiography. It's not pure hero worship. It is a very honest and complicated view of a very complicated, very human person who was larger than life to much of the world, but in this book is really conveyed as a person with all the complexities and good and bad traits that any of us have. I really got to know him in a way I never did while he was with us. As I tell Lori in this interview, I'm very grateful to her for producing this book. I'm grateful to the folks at Echo, who were actually my publisher on my last book, for putting it out. I think you all are going to enjoy it tremendously. And that's all I'm going to say about it before I get to the interview. As always, our feature interview on the show is presented by Sam Pellegrino, whether in life or on the plate, every chef has a story to tell. Sam Pellegrino proudly helps them share those stories in their restaurants and right here on Andrew Talks to Chefs. The perfect complement to great food and meaningful interactions, Sam Pellegrino is delighted to be a part of the conversation. Learn more at sampellegrino.com. And with that, I'm going to get you to it. My conversation with Lori Wolliver, author of Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. Here you go. Lori, welcome to the show. This book, obviously, I think this is probably not an unusual response. I love the book. I guess it's fair to say that. It was also a bit of an emotional roller coaster for me to read it. I guess my first question for you is, how soon after Tony's death did this idea of even doing this come about, and how much time did you spend on it?
First of all, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be talking to you today. As far as the timing of the book, it actually came about very quickly after Tony's death. I'd say within a few weeks, there were all kinds of conversations going on between myself and the publisher and our agent, Kim Witherspoon, and Tony's production partners in television. Everyone just kind of constantly checking in with each other, really just making sure that we were all okay, and then starting to talk about the future of all of the things that we had going on with Tony and what any of that might look like going forward. So I was already engaged in the process of writing World Travel and Irreverent Guide, which is a book that we started co-authoring together and that I put out earlier this year. And then Kim Witherspoon and Daniel Halpern, Tony's longtime publisher and editor at Echo, came to me and we started to talk about the idea of some form of biography that would come from a very informed kind of insider place. And it just made sense to all three of us to have me be the person to do it because of my nearly a decade of being Tony's assistant, as well as having already co-authored a book with him, Appetites, a cookbook, which we published in 2016, and then already again being engaged in the process of writing World Travel. So it just kind of made all the sense in the world. And although it was emotionally a difficult decision to start memorializing someone who I really had only just begun to accept that he was no longer with us, it felt like the right decision. And I'm so glad to have been able to do this book.
What was your own personal, I referred to what for me was the emotional roller coaster of reading it, mm-hmm. right? Because you go through this person's entire life, the ups and downs. And also, as promised in the promotional materials, even for people who feel like they know a lot about Anthony Bourdain, there's a lot of new information about him here. And some of it to me was actually very surprising. It's also very unflinching, which I want to talk about. Mm. But for you, what was sort of the up and down of working on this book? I mean, as you said, the loss was relatively fresh when you decide to get into it. This was someone you spent about a decade with. You were talking to people, many of whom you knew already and many of whom knew him intimately from various points in his life. I would imagine this was an emotionally tempestuous period of time. What was it like for you just going through this process?
Sure. Yeah, it was absolutely emotionally difficult in general, you know, reeling in the loss of someone who had such an outsized influence on my life day to day and who had been such a sort of steadfast supporter and friend, in addition to being a really excellent employer and just someone that I knew was special to the world. That was a, you know, a tremendous loss. I think it can't be overstated. I will say that working on this book felt really therapeutic in a lot of ways, just to have a reason to talk to people about Tony for an end goal, for a project, not just having, you know, the kind of conversations that you have in grief and loss, but doing something with it, doing something productive with it, which I think is something that Tony would have approved of, I hope. Who's to say? It was, for me, a much easier emotional process than writing World Travel, which I found enormously lonely and a very, very sad thing, because I had been meant to be writing that with Tony, and I knew how much fun it could be to write a book with him. So to suddenly be tasked with all of it on my own was really sad. And so writing this book, this biography, was sort of an antidote to that and helped me meet people that I didn't know. There were a lot of people in the book that I knew and had professional relationships with or friendships with, but there are a number of people that I never got a chance to meet in working with Tony. And so it was really interesting and really valuable from an emotional and intellectual standpoint to talk with those people and get the early story and get their analyses and their recollections, which made, for me, a much more nuanced understanding of who Tony was.
I used the word unflinching a minute ago. There's some moments that are recounted in the book by people who cared about Tony, many of whom knew him a long time. Mm-hmm. They don't show him and this is by far the minority of moments in the book, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a moment that really stuck with me. It was like a very old friend of his giving him shit about not being in touch with the old gang anymore. Mm-hmm. And Tony says, "You guys don't understand me. Mario understands me. Eric understands me," referring to Batali and Repair. Mm-hmm. And the guy's response was, "Not only do we understand you, but we made you," right? Mm-hmm. That's almost a cinematic moment. I mean, it's so perfect, right, in mm-hmm. what it's describing. Was it tough for you to include moments like that in the book? Or did you kind of feel like this is the way, if this project were going to happen, that he would have wanted it to be this sort of 360 in its depiction?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Tony would have been mortified if this was simply just a hagiography and everyone just talking about what a great guy he was. You know, he knew that he was an imperfect human. He was very aware of his own faults and flaws and the mistakes that he had made. I have to believe that this is something that he would approve of more so than everyone just sort of, you know, making him into a martyr, which I think he would have been embarrassed by. You're right that the love and admiration and respect shown to him in this book do outweigh the sort of negative parts. But I think overall, he would want, and I know I wanted, and I think that most readers want a more honest and nuanced look at who this guy was. He also was, if you read anything that he's written or watch any number of his television shows, he was pretty honest about who he was there too. He was unflinching in his assessment of other people and things, and the way that he could sort of get away with that and balance that out is he was equally honest and unflinching about himself. So I think that this book really carries that thread through in talking to the people that he knew throughout his whole life.
Yeah, it is funny. And I am always quick to say this. I mean, I knew him a little bit. He was super kind to me in some ways. One or two of those you were a key part of, you know, making happen. But I wasn't like a close friend of Tony's. I didn't know him on a personal level. But the word that does seem to come up, even with those of us who didn't know him intimately in the wake of his death, was, you know, words like humility and humble. And I think that's very stunning to people who never met the man, right? But I do think that the way that kind of undercut, you know, what a lot of people in the book refer to as, you know, the quote unquote bad boy image was kind of fascinating. And, you know, you talk about this honesty. One of my favorite moments of his, and I'm sure I'm the only person who probably remembers this, and I just happened upon it. It wasn't a show I watched with any regularity, but I think Joy Behar had briefly a talk show. Mm. I forget even what network it was on. And I happened by it one night and she was interviewing him and she was talking about how he used to take people to task, you know, for things like selling out. He just started laughing and said, well, I can't really do that anymore. And she said, because you've become part of the problem. And he said, yeah, I've become part of the problem, you know, and it was so charming, you know, and so refreshing to see him say that. The other word that comes up a lot in this book, Lori, which I'd love you to maybe speak to for a minute, because I do, again, find this to be something that for people who maybe haven't known people who've achieved his level of fame, because it is not the most uncommon thing, but shyness. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk in this book about his fundamental shyness. Mm-hmm. I'll just put it out there that broadly. Can you just speak to it, whether from the vantage point of some of the people you quote in the book or, you know, or maybe even just in your own words?
It was something that struck me the first time I met him, which was in 2002. I had, of course, read Kitchen Confidential like everyone else, and he had hired me kind of sight unseen to do editing and testing for Anthony Bourdain's Les Halles cookbook, which was his first cookbook. And so I was, I think like many people, expecting a certain archetype of brashness and charisma and swagger and, you know, just pretty much expecting what I saw on the page to be the full expression of the human. And he was very humble and shy and maybe didn't make that much eye contact. And our meeting was pretty brief and he deferred to the other people at the table quite a bit. There were two co-authors on the book, Philippe Lajeunie, who's also interviewed in the book, and José de Moraes, who was Tony's co-chef or sort of, I guess he was his boss at one point at Les Halles. So my recollection of that time is that I was really surprised by what a kind of quiet, soft-spoken and shy guy that he was. And I never really knew whether that was just because it was me and it was someone he didn't know. And that was just the way that he was with new people, or if there was something about me that made him uncomfortable. And that's something that I kind of never really was sure of throughout the entirety of working with him, if he was more outgoing with other people. And then to speak to a number of people for the book who had the exact same experience, Panio Giannopoulos, who was the editor on Kitchen Confidential, he was working with Bloomsbury at the time, and he talks a lot about his interactions with Tony in that same time period of 2000 to 2004, maybe, as you never really kind of knew where you stood with Tony, and he was shy. And I think the way that he countered that, Tony, was to lean into that public version of himself where he would be telling a story and it was just the two of you, but it was the exact same kind of cadence and presentation as if he were on stage or as if he were being filmed for television or as if he were narrating a piece of an audio book. And it was always this odd sense of, is he just waiting for the rest of the audience to show up? Or is he holding me at a level of remove so that he can feel comfortable in his own skin? I mean, it was really striking.
It was like a performance.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always am quick to say the Tony that you see on television and in other public spheres is not so different from the Tony that you see in real life. But the Tony in real life was always, I think, to an extent, doing a performance, giving whoever was around what he thought they might want or need. It's not to say that we didn't have genuine conversations, because we absolutely did. But there was always a sense that he was, I think, performing the role of himself. And that I think that is something that gets touched on pretty extensively in the book, from the kitchen days in the 80s all the way through to the end of his life. I think Nigella Lawson touches on that really beautifully. I mean, she had such a love and admiration for him, and they had a true friendship, but she also was aware that he was, I don't want to say struggling, that sounds too, that overstates the case, but that there was an effort being made to sort of be the charming public persona that people were looking for from him.
And also that he crafted a little bit for himself, right? This was one of the revelations to me in the book. You know, there's a lot of talk in maybe the first third of the book or first quarter of the book about how badly he wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And that this was something, it wasn't like he was just this knockaround cook slash chef who stumbled into the literary realm, right? This was something that he had been working at for quite some time.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know how many casual observers understood that, right? But this was something that he wanted for himself badly, desperately, you might say, until he had it.
Absolutely. The New Yorker writer Patrick Radden Keefe, who had written a beautiful profile of Tony in 2017, he talked about this, how Tony had presented one version of himself in interviews, that he was kind of casual about the act of writing, and that really his whole life up until Kitchen Confidential had been about being a cook and a chef. And being the New Yorker writer that he is, and the, you know, the brilliant nonfiction writer, he did his research. He did his homework. He went to NYU and found this archive of correspondence between Tony and his friend Joel Rose, who had a literary magazine called Between C and D. And he found these great letters from Tony to Joel that really showcased that hunger, that desire to be a writer, you know, seeking advice from Joel and talking about his own insecurities. And there's one of the letters is in the photo insert of the book, and it's just so telling. And you know, Patrick talks about it. Joel certainly talks about his journey with Tony from the 80s straight through to the end of his life as friends and writing partners, and Joel was a kind of writing mentor to Tony. So it really was something that Tony took very seriously, that he worked at. I think it's very useful to me as a writer, and I think to any writers that are listening, it's very useful to remember that he didn't just wake up one day and write Kitchen Confidential out of nothing. This was a culmination of many, many years of honing these stories as, you know, stories that he would tell out loud and stories that he would write down. Kitchen Confidential was the result of many, many years of effort and rejection and failure and revision and editing. And I think that is useful for any of us who wonder, why can't we write this next, you know, bestseller out of nothing? Writing is always work, and it's always rejection and always editing and back and forth. It was interesting to me that in some instances, in some parts of his own self-mythologizing, Tony sort of scrubbed away at the edges of the idea that it's something that he actually worked very hard at.
Well, and also, I mean, to your point about writing being this kind of process of discovering what you're about, he didn't quite get it. You know, this was another revelation to me in the book. You know, he had to kind of be nudged in the direction of nonfiction, right? By people. Joel was one of them, you know, who showed it to Karen Rinaldi, who ended up, you know, publishing Kitchen Confidential. That, I forget the exact words, but it was sort of that, like, the in-between stuff was actually the great stuff. He had published some novels before. Right. He connected with Kitchen Confidential. And, you know, Joel had this observation that it's all this observational stuff about restaurant life that is gold, right? Tony didn't necessarily see that. He needed, you know, what in film would be the producer, right? Or in publishing is the editor slash publisher, or just the observant friend to kind of light that path for him a little bit.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's a great story that Joel and Karen tell about Tony being in Japan and writing this kind of life-changing email about what he was seeing and experiencing. This was his very first time in Japan. He really hadn't traveled very much at all. He was maybe 40, 41, 42 years old, and just his stream of consciousness observations in Tokyo. And it's, you know, it's possible given how smart he was and how he knew what he was doing. He may very well have written this email to Joel looking for encouragement, looking for him to share it with Karen, or somehow, trying to tip the balance into writing about nonfiction, but it maybe not. That's just my observation or my guess. But regardless, he wrote something to Joel, who he was always trying to impress and really looked up to as a writer. And Joel, you know, showed it to his wife, Karen, who was a publisher and editor. And that was sort of the beginning of the story. Tony also had a professional relationship with Webb and Rob Stone, who are sort of book producers, packagers. And they too, and this was before Kitchen Confidential and sort of in the midst of when he was writing his novels, they too pointed out to him the real stuff, the real story of you. That's where the gold is. That's where the best reading and writing is coming from. So you know, think about focusing on that. And then it was Joel and Karen who really, you know, pushed it over the edge and got him to write Kitchen Confidential.
Can we talk about addiction for a minute? I feel like that is one of the it's a little facile to say it, but it does feel to me, looking at it, you know, that people often say of those with addictive personalities, you know, they've swapped one addiction for another. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wrote about this in Kitchen Confidential, discussed in this book. He had a heroin habit in his younger days. You look at his relationship to work and to travel. You look at the ill-fated relationship with Asia toward the end of his life. These seem like very addictive patterns. Do you think that's too easy an overlay to put on his story, or does that resonate with you?
It does resonate with me. You know, I'm always hesitant to diagnose, right, or to say with any kind of certainty. It's a tricky thing. You know, there were a number of people who were acquaintances and writing colleagues of Tony's who I approached to do interviews for this book who are themselves, you know, self-identified addicts in recovery. And there were three of them. And each one of them said, you know what, I don't feel comfortable commenting on Tony's addiction because he's not here anymore, because it wasn't something that he ever acknowledged, despite the fact that he wrote and spoke extensively about his heroin use and the way that in which he stopped using heroin. I don't know that he ever truly identified as an addict. In the time that he was alive, I didn't necessarily see him as such, even though now, in retrospect, and having had all these conversations and having had 3.5 years to think about it and analyze it, I think, well, my God, of course he was an addict. You know, it's so obvious. It's a delicate thing. That being said, no, I don't think it's too big an overstatement to say that all of the way in which he approached the things that he was passionate about was absolutely addict behavior. I think for me personally, I'm only able to say that with some level of confidence now because of my own journey through the 12-step life. I wasn't able to recognize addict behavior in Tony because I was engaging in it myself. And now that I've had a little time in the rooms, as they say, and some sober time, I can see it more clearly. It's delicate because I think Tony would chafe. It becomes this kind of catch-22 where he, because he was an addict, I think he would not recognize himself as such. You know, he would not want to be labeled an addict. And he certainly never showed any interest in doing the kinds of recovery that are suggested for addicts. So these are the challenges of writing about and analyzing and trying to learn more about somebody who's no longer here to counter whatever the narrative is that we have about him. Does that answer your question?
No, it does. And, you know, I'm reminded of this line. I mean, I'll be honest, I have not watched Roadrunner yet. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with my interest in the subject or, you know, Morgan Neville's made what's probably my favorite documentary, which is 20 Feet from Stardom. Mm-hmm. I just haven't been able to bring myself to watch it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to be melodramatic. Sure. I mean, obviously I could survive the experience. Mm-hmm. It's just, I want to save it for a time when I feel like I'll be able to enjoy it a little more. Yeah. But there's that line that I know is, I think it's quoted in the movie and it is in the book about toward the end of his life where he says, all I ask for is a little fucking discretion. Mm-hmm. When that line does really resonate with me, you know, even having barely known him, that really, it's one of those lines you hear it and it seems to say so much more than just the handful of words it contains. Yeah. I have a lot of respect for everything you're saying. You know, this might be too personal, Lori. Tell me if it is. But, you know, in reading this book and the shyness piece of him, to me, at least in the little bit that I know you, I felt like maybe there was a little bit of a kernel that helped me understand the bond you two had, because I have sort of experienced a similar dichotomy in you between your kind of persona on the page or even in social media, which can be, you know, to use an outdated word, a little fierce and definitely very fearless. But, you know, I experience you in person. You do the same thing. I do the same thing, right? You and I have met many times. Mm-hmm. You always at a conference or an event when we used to have those kinds of things in our lives, you would always come up and reintroduce yourself to me, right? Which is something I do. And I've known you probably now for maybe 20 years since I knew you, I met you before you worked for Tony. Mm. That kind of dichotomy between a public persona or a writerly persona and a fundamentally shy individual, that seemed to me to be something you two shared. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think it is. I think that I wouldn't have necessarily thought that when Tony was alive and I was working for him, you know, I just thought about how different we were. But it's true. I am, you know, I was raised to be kind of polite and obedient and quiet. And, you know, I am a little shy, but the comfort and safety of posting, you know, kind of outrageous stuff on Instagram or writing something and having it out in the world away from me, or you know, saying things on my own podcast that are kind of vulgar or outrageous. That does. I mean, I can understand Tony through that. Both of these things are who I am, right? Like, I am shy. I can be reserved. I can be kind of, I do always assume that no one remembers me because I you know, you've been around this world of food media for a long time and just kind of New York media in general. And there's a lot of big personalities and there are people who are very memorable. And then there are people like myself who I think are just kind of, I feel that I kind of blend into the woodwork. And I certainly felt that way more in my 20s and 30s when I had sort of less confidence and wasn't really taking care of myself. And I just felt like, oh, I'm just another like dumpy girl in her 30s, you know? So I've had a number of times where people don't remember me and I certainly remember them. And it's kind of embarrassing and it kind of hurts your feelings, you know, when you're like, no, I've met you a couple times, you know, but I didn't register for whatever reason. So I started reintroducing myself to people as sort of a self-defensive mechanism. And sometimes it totally backfires and it makes the other person feel insulted. Like, of course I remember you.
Well, I'm sorry. I feel like I've put you into this defensive position.
Fine.
I do the same thing. To your point, though, there are also a lot of people in this industry who won't remember you.
Yeah.
So, that's the, you know, there's certain people of whom I say, you know, every time I run into them, it's like the first time.
Yeah.
Had anyone else done the definitive oral biography of Anthony Bourdain, you would have been someone for sure who would have been interviewed and probably would have been quoted at length. Mm. You were not in this book, except, you know, you do write an introduction and you write your acknowledgments. Did you at any point consider including your own voice amongst the quotes? I know that would have been unusual, but I am wondering. Mm-hmm. And then my second question is, were you to have done that, are there any points that Laurie Wolliver would have made as a voice in this book that nobody else managed to make?
So to answer the first question, yes. In fact, Daniel Halpern said, I really think that you ought to be interviewed for this book also. And it hadn't occurred to me. I didn't really want to be, but you know, if your editor and publisher tells you to do something, you do it pretty much. So I did find somebody to interview me, and it was a really useful exercise. And ultimately I decided that everything I said had been either said before by someone else, or I just didn't feel, I couldn't find anything that felt so compelling and so different from what somebody else had said that it was worth overcoming the great hesitation I had to arrogantly include my own quotes in there. It just felt strange to me. And I know what my experience with Tony was and my memories and the analysis that I've been able to kind of lay over all of the experiences that I've had with him. I think where my voice comes through in this book, apart from the introduction and some of the interstitials, is just the choices that I made in what to include in this book and how to structure it. Obviously, when you do close to 100 interviews, there are hundreds and hundreds of hours and hundreds of thousands of words that don't make it into the final cut. So I think, like a documentary editor or director, my influence is on every page based on the choices that I made. I did an interview for the film, for Roadrunner, because I was asked to. It wasn't something that I was dying to do, but I was a consulting producer on the film. And so I felt that whatever was required of me, whether it was to be on camera or to do the offstage stuff that I did, that I would say yes to. I was very careful in that interview to not say too much. There were certainly things that I wanted certain ideas and certain recollections and analyses that I wanted to be included in that film, but I didn't necessarily want to be the one to say them. It really, you're really committing yourself to something by being on camera. And a lot of times they were thoughts or conclusions that I had based on extensive conversation that I had with other people who knew Tony. So I didn't necessarily even feel that they were my direct observations, but more sort of synthesis that happened after the fact, or in some cases during, while Tony was still alive. I mean, he was a topic of discussion and some concern in life as well as afterward. So I don't know that there are any unique observations that were only things that I would know about Tony. You know, I saw him tell stories and share observations about himself. I learned this through the process of doing the interviews. There were things that he might have told me in confidence that then other people shared, if not the exact same thing, then a very similar anecdote or recollection. I think it would be very arrogant of me to say that, you know, I had a singular type of relationship with Tony. I think he had a number of people that he felt comfortable at times confiding in.
This is, again, there's so many people who have, you know, it reminds me almost of years ago when Ben Stiller had a show. I think it might have been on the Fox Network. Mm-hmm. It was a skit show. Mm-hmm. And they had this recurring bit, Legends of Springsteen. Mm. And did you ever see this? It was I was cleaning up the bar after hours and a woman went into labor and out of nowhere, you know, the boss appeared, you know, and delivered the baby. And you know, there are these stories about Tony Bourdain, his generosity to young writers. Mm-hmm. A young cook comes up to him at a book signing and ends up talking to him for an ungodly amount of time, mm-hmm. always willing to pose for the selfie, mm-hmm. for no matter, you know, how big a flash mob, you know, formed. There's a line in the book toward the end, and it kind of broke my heart, where he says to a friend, you know, I want to run down to the bodega, and it used to take 5 minutes, and now it takes an hour. His generosity of spirit, of time, of access, you know, was part of his legend. Was there ever an effort made by those close to him, or did he ever, you know, there is another way to go with it, right? There's the, you know, the sunglasses and the cap and the, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of stab at being incognito, or at least making it clear you're not, you know, looking for new friends, you know, as you walk down the street. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time where he thought about at least intermittently kind of, you know, putting the top up on the convertible and not being so accessible to people? It really does seem like something that took a toll.
Yeah. I do think that there were efforts made, I think, especially in the later years of making television. I think there were certain methods of maybe getting him out of the building, you know, garage exits and basements and that kind of thing. I think he had gotten better at figuring out sort of what his limits were. If he found himself in a situation where he was being approached, he wouldn't run away and he would never tell anybody to fuck off. But he wasn't constantly, you know, unwittingly exposing himself to the public. I think he had gotten decent at figuring out ways to take a break when he needed to. I had this great experience with him in Tokyo. We were there in 2016. They were shooting an episode of Parts Unknown that was focusing on Masa and his history in Japan. And there was a visit with his family. But part of the shoot took place in Tokyo. And he and I arrived ahead of the crew. They were driving across the country from Kanazawa. Tony and I had taken the train and had gone out to get a quick dinner. And then we're back in the hotel in the elevator. And he really hadn't been spotted too much, which was interesting because he really stands out in Tokyo. But there just weren't that many Westerners around, I guess, to notice him. And maybe the Japanese are more polite and reserved about approaching people. I think they certainly are. So we had been pretty much unbothered through dinner in two different locations, and then a walk through the Golden Guy, and then we got back to the hotel, get in the elevator, and there's a woman who recognizes him and just starts gushing and talking to him. And, you know, this is a very typical situation where she's telling him about, you know, her daughter has been traveling and they just love it. She just loves his show. And, you know, very nice kind of general platitudes about what a fan she is. And I watch him and he's listening to her and he's nodding his head and he makes these noises that approximate words, but he never actually articulates a word. And he somehow gives this woman the impression that she has had a conversation with Tony Bourdain, but he never actually articulates a word. It was fascinating to me, and that he was able to kind of, you know, not let her in too much and not get too engaged in a conversation in a hotel elevator, but still give her what she wanted, which was just a little bit of acknowledgement. And I thought that was such a sort of brilliant way to handle it. I don't know if it always would work, but it worked in that moment. And I was just like, wow, you're really good at this.
That is an amazing story. I don't know even exactly how to put this question because it's kind of a trite question, but I do need to ask it. Mm-hmm. This is someone you spent about a decade of your life in very close proximity to, mm-hmm. a lot of time together, someone who leaves us by suicide. You go through this multi-year process of telling their story. Mm-hmm. For you, coming out of it, how did it affect, I guess maybe as I'm saying the sentence, I don't want to maybe even put it in the past tense. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to say, how did it affect your relationship to this person?
I think that having done all of these interviews and having spent so much time thinking about and talking about Tony, going back and reading everything, watching all the shows, it has given me so much more empathy for him and so much of a greater understanding of him than I had in life. Of course, I respected and admired him. I was, you know, I cared deeply about him and wanted to do well for him. But I think were he still alive, I think I would have a much shallower understanding of who he was. And believe me, I would trade that in a heartbeat. I would much rather understand him less and have him living today. But it has, I will say, especially watching the film, watching Roadrunner for the first time, I was so grateful to get a cut of it before it started, played at the Tribeca Film Festival. It just broke my fucking heart open all over again, just seeing his humanity, seeing his vulnerability, seeing that he was trying his best in his way, you know, that he was just a mortal guy who was so smart and so charismatic and was just doing what his gut and his heart told him to do. So all of this process of these two books and all of this grieving that I've been doing has just made me understand him a lot more. So my hope is that with this book, even people who feel that they know everything about him because they've been big fans of his writing and his television work, I hope that they will also get the chance to understand him as a more nuanced, complete person and have some better understanding of why he made the terrible choice that he made at the end of his life.
And Lori, if you don't mind my asking, do we know yet what's next for Lori Wolliver?
Great question. Well, I have started working on a book working title is A Book About Bread, and it's a bread baking book with the baker Richard Hart, who is a phenomenally talented guy. He's British. He spent about 6 or 8 years as the head baker at Tartine in San Francisco, and then he went on to open Hart Boggery in Copenhagen under the umbrella of the Noma Group, and so he's making really exceptional breads there. I went and spent 2 weeks with him in Copenhagen this summer, and I'll probably go back in the winter just to see what hell it is to be that far north in the wintertime. And so we're writing a book that's everything a person needs to know to bake really great bread at home. So that's been a nice change of pace for me that has nothing to do with Tony and has nothing to do with suicide and is just about food, which is kind of my first love. And I'm working on a couple of other things that are still pretty early on, but more in the realm of producing and doing some stuff for the screen based on my experience with Tony, both sort of in a fictional realm and also in a more kind of storytelling realm around food and the intersection of chefs and musicians. So there's some stuff I'm really excited about, and I hope that it goes through and I can continue to write and edit and, you know, do creative projects and not have to get a desk job.
All right. Well, Lori, I, as you know, Tony was someone who was very important to me. I'm grateful for this book, you know, to hear you describe what your mission with it was, you know, at least from this reader's point of view. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was, you know, brilliantly accomplished. I'm grateful for it. And I look forward to seeing what you do next. Thank you very much for coming on the pod.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Lori Wolliver. And again, I highly recommend Lori's new book, Bourdain, the Definitive Oral Biography. It does officially publish this coming Tuesday, September 28, 2021, but you don't need to wait to order it up online right now. Andrew Talks to Chefs is produced by Table 12 Productions. The show is written, booked, edited, mixed, and hosted by me, Andrew Friedman. If you'd like to support us, the best way to do that is by spreading the word and letting people know about us in an increasingly crowded podcast field. You can post about us on social media. If you'd like to tag us on Instagram, our handle there is @chefpodcast. You can tell a friend about us if you like. And it's also helpful if you would rate or review us on Apple Podcasts. That really does help people find the show. Our thanks, as always, to After School Special for our music. Please check out their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre, on iTunes. Again, you can follow us on Instagram. The handle there is @chefpodcast. And as always, thank you for listening, and we will see you back here soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.